Welcome back to this week's installment of Expand Your Mind and Be Kind. Thanks for joining Ryan and I on our adventure, and I hope everyone enjoys our episode. Thank you.
Today's quote is, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress." That's from Frederick Douglass. Is that Jim?
It is I.
Yes, Jimbo Slice.
Welcome back to the Jim and Ryan podcast, where we kick ass and take names.
Crikey, and then we hop inside a kangaroo's pouch and hop on down the gully.
What was that episode we did where just like impromptu started talking like Australians and we went on for like a few minutes?
I don't know. It was probably our either least or most popular episode.
It's probably our least popular. I know my Australian accent isn't up to your par, Ryan.
No, I think it's great. I like your Australian accent.
Ryan, yours is better.
Well, it's not about comparing or any of those kinds of things. It's just they're different. Which brings us to our conversation for today, that we are going to revisit the topic of anti-racism, which was actually our first topic we ever discussed on the podcast, which is, can't believe it's been a few months short of a year since we've been doing this. But yeah. So, Jim, do you have any thoughts on how your views or information that you have has changed or altered your perspective on this topic, or just anything that you want to kick off with?
Gosh, it feels crazy that it's almost been a year since we started this adventure. If anything, I feel like I have simply just gotten more passionate about this cause and tried to empower myself a little more with knowledge. I think it's something that us white people just don't do.
Yeah.
And it honestly makes me almost ashamed to be a white person sometimes.
I think there is a decent amount of shame and guilt associated when people talk about something like racism, because it's often people like to ignore that it exists or deny that it exists and come up with reasoning or justification because it's uncomfortable to talk about. And it's also kind of an admitting that people were mistreated and are mistreated, and that while we live in a legally equitable society, there are aspects of how our society operates that are still unequal and still need adjustment. And coming to terms with the past of our country and how African Americans were treated from the time that they were brought here in the 1600s to the time that we live in now, where there are a lot of socioeconomic disparities and related anywhere from law enforcement to just day-to-day interactions.
So like a big defense, I know, for, you know, people who are, for lack of a better word, like Blue Lives Matter people who are very pro-police and, you know, very rushed to the defense of our law enforcement system is, well, if they're not criminals, they wouldn't be in this situation in the first place. Or it's not like there was actually more white people killed last year than there were black people, or stuff like that. And that is just, it's gross, ignorant generalizations that don't actually bear any substance, because if you looked into any of those things, you would realize just like how that doesn't even apply. So like, yes, more white people are killed per year than black people, but per capita it's like 40 to 50% more. And the same goes with like our incarceration rates in this country too. And that is directly correlated to poverty. There is more crime when there's more poverty. That is a fact. And if you look at the history of African Americans in this country, it has been a grueling, harsh story where this ethnic group of people has tried to make a living in the United States of America, land of the free, home of the brave, equal opportunity for all, since the very beginning. And they've had all the cards stacked against them the whole way. So I know, kind of like, I feel like I'm pontificating here, but
no. So I do want to ask, how, what do you think is the downfall, or the, I guess, negative outcome of admitting that those kinds of things exist for the people who are pretty staunch defenders of the police or just the institutions as they stand? Because I've also heard quite a few people say, well, if people, you know, if black people, or just I've heard just poor people in general, and this isn't directly specifically related to black people, but it's white and or any other, you know, ethnicity or race, that we hear that it's like, you just need to get a better job, or like go provide
pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
And I think that's kind of denying the existence of a lot of institutional and policies that are inherently racist and cause a natural disparity between people's ability to make a good life and be able to provide for themselves.
That I think it's topics like these where it's so important to understand your history. And I am no expert of the history of African Americans in the United States, but I have tried desperately to read into it and find it, make sense of the present. And if you look at black history, it sucks. So slavery existed until but since before our country was a country in the colonial times, till 1865, the end of the Civil War, when it was officially abolished. So during that entire time, African Americans lived as subhuman. They were seen as cattle. They were seen as beasts of burden to till fields and to work and produce goods for their masters. Then when 100 years after the creation of our country, which touted equality and freedom, took 100 years for us to finally acknowledge that like a good chunk of the people living in our country were actually equal and free, like the furthest thing from reality actually happened because of, you know, the post-Confederate people in our country, or that just thanks to the extreme racism in our country, suddenly all of these humans that were slaves were out of a job They had to like make their own way. They didn't get any assistance or help from the government. I mean, there was some small programs, but nothing that was substantial. And then they were suddenly expected to just make money and be successful. It was like they took the people in the socioeconomic class of being a slave, which is the worst economic status you could have, took that away from them, ripped the rug out from underneath them, kicked it while they were down, spit on them, and then said, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and become successful. Like, that's where the origin of true, like, of not true, but like African American poverty started.
Yeah, so it was like being in the frying pan, being tossed into the fire in some respects, yeah. Where it's like, yeah, you're no longer considered a slave, but you need to figure all this stuff out and start from absolutely nothing. And not only does society not value you, even though you're technically not a slave anymore, society does not value you the same as a white person. And so not only do you start with nothing, but you're also going to be given less when you do work for something because, mm-hmm. yeah, you're just not seen as equal, even though the technicality is that you're equal.
Well, there were so many laws put into place too that made it physically impossible for African Americans to get into politics, to have a voice, or even to vote for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, think of like some of the really racist policies like Jim Crow and
they used to make people, black people, pay to vote.
Yeah.
There was a poll tax. Like, what the, when, on what planet is that ever considered free and fair?
It's definitely not. And we can see relics of that today. I mean, not necessarily yeah. a poll tax, but I mean, some of the, I consider racist legislation for polling places that require or that don't allow poll workers to give people who have been waiting in line food or drink or any of those kinds of things. I mean, if you have to sit in line to vote for hours on end and you're not able to be given water or like any of those kinds of things, like
even a bigger question, why the hell are there fucking lines?
Right.
This is the United States of America and we live in the 21st century. Why is there one voting place for like a whole precinct that has like, you know, over like 500,000 people in it or something ridiculous like that? That's exaggerated, but it gets the point across.
Right. And I don't want to string into a tangent about party politics, but I'm kind of a pretty, at least my view today is that it's pretty difficult to divorce some of those policies and some of those movements from the Republican Party. I can't think of, I mean,
well, it's because it's our party system's consolidated, you know, the Republican and the Democratic parties are collections of old parties of the past. Where do the racist parties go? The Republican Party. That's why the African Americans have thrown their lot in to the Democratic Party, because it's the party that is the party of the anti-abolitionists.
Yeah, but I wonder, because I mean, I've seen countless discussions, whether that's on Reddit or any other platform, where people go back and forth and say and try to defend the policies as not being racist and as not being limiting to people's abilities and rights to vote and all those different kinds of things. And I try to be open-minded about it and understand where they're coming from, but I don't really hear good arguments. A lot of it is like, well, people shouldn't be giving other people food and drinks while they're waiting to vote. I'm using that as just an example, but I don't know. I would love to hear your thoughts on what's a way that we can be more understanding to people's struggles in society that like we can create policies around that do enable and provide resources? Like, what are like one or two things that you can think of that would be helpful to kind of set people up for success when it comes to either African Americans that are disenfranchised and put in economically destitute positions, whether that's like a legacy thing because they grew up in a poor neighborhood, their parents were poor, their parents were poor. What are some things that you can think of that could better equip people to have a better chance of opportunity, escaping that cycle of economic destitution?
I mean, that's a whole overarching reform of our entire governmental system.
Well, yeah.
But like, realistically, honestly, like, unified federal laws on voting. You know, I think there's too much room for interpretation on how we vote and when we vote and stuff. I think the voting day, election day should be a national holiday. And I think there needs to be unified rules all across the country, federally mandated, that say how you can vote, instead of all of this like wishy-washy states can kind of decide for themselves how they're going to vote. It's like, no, we're all voting for the same things federally. So why should the states have different voices in how they're going to go about doing that?
That's fair. So having kind of a standardized voting principle and policy.
For federal elections, I should say, like state elections, that's different.
I think it's difficult to, yeah, there are definitely some conflicts with the whole concept of state versus federal control. And there's always going to be kind of a tension between how much force and control does the federal government have over our day-to-day lives.
Right.
And so people would see something like instituting a national holiday for voting. I mean, there's a reason it hasn't been done yet. And I'm not really sure why, but I mean, I'm sure it has something to do with disrupting commerce and all those different kinds of things where
always a reason
where it can't really be justified.
I think we should, I mean, out of the things we've talked about in this episode so far, we definitely have like 2 to 3 other episodes worth of talking points.
Sure. Yeah.
I think we should kind of steer our conversation maybe more towards the police shootings. But what do you think? I feel like that is like popped right back into the news in the last couple of months for various very obvious reasons.
Yeah, I think I'm good with talking about that. I do think it would be helpful to kind of set the stage for like what we would want to bring to that conversation, because I think there's space to not really have anything valuable to bring to it. And then there's also we're just echoing what everybody else has been saying or thinking about it. So I also want it to be a substantive discussion if we're thinking of like really focusing in on that. And to be perfectly honest with you, I know about several of the high profile, but I don't know the minutia of like exactly who lately. I know there have been a few.
Dante Wright is the one that everyone's talking about right now, because he's the 20-year-old who, Minnesota again, I don't know what the heck is with Minnesota, but he was the one who was shot and killed because the police officer thought she was pulling her taser out.
I have very lightly heard of this case, so maybe you could fill me in on it.
Essentially, a black guy was pulled over and he called his mom, who was white, and he's like, hey, what should I do? I'm nervous. Like, they're pulling me over because I think they're pulling me over because I have an air freshener on my rearview mirror, which is actually illegal in Minnesota. And according, the police, for their report, said they pulled him over because his tags were expired. But when they got him out of the car, they got to his car and did all their checks, they were like, oh, this guy has like a small warrant for like some misdemeanor or like a small crime he had done. They were going to arrest him. And so he tried to like break out of the handcuffs and run. And one of the other police officers said she thought she'd pulled out her taser and then shot him with her gun.
Well, that's terrible.
Killed him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think really how is as important as like that it's happening. I mean, I can't imagine the constant fear that goes through an African American person when they're around police officers. That shouldn't be a thing. Our police officers should be people that we, when we're around, should make us feel safe. You know, that and encourage us that, you know, if somebody breaks the law around us, they're gonna take care of us. But that is like farthest from the truth, and especially for African American people, because of all the accidents or seemingly accidents that have happened, like how could you possibly feel safe? Like, and the people who have been killed because they were jogging or because they pulled out a bag of Skittles or like whatever whatever happened, those people didn't have to lose their lives.
True.
In those situations. So, and I think that goes into a whole different conversation about police reform.
Yeah, I mean,
but
so I was listening to a podcast, and they were talking about, it's actually one of the leaders of the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu company, mm-hmm. or organization. Are you familiar with that or them?
I'm not.
So the Gracies are kind of I think this guy's great granddad or his granddad, they created Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And they were talking about how he and his brother teach and train police officers in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu as a way to, you know, disarm and apprehend people who are, you know, being violent against a police encounter. Somebody's resisting arrest, like all those different kinds of things. And supposedly, I don't know a ton about jiu-jitsu, but I do know that it's like closing the gap, like trying to get as close as you possibly can and like, yeah, restrain.
It's
whoever it is. And that it's seen as, if somebody is trained well with it, it can be a really effective way to disarm an opponent and also to control them in those kinds of situations where you're not having to use a firearm to control the person that's being violent towards you or resisting arrest or those kinds of things. And one of the facts that he threw out there is that, and he's just speaking specifically in the state of California, that police officers are given 4 hours of, I can't remember exactly what he called it, but it's basically like how to restrain and control people that are trying to do harm against you, or resisting arrest or those different kinds of things. And that 4 hours of training every 2 years encapsulates actual physical training where they're like being taught tactics and different kinds of things to do that. And then the rest of it is education on the laws around what they can and cannot do. And so in those situations, if my fight or flight response is activated and I'm not a well-trained person, I mean, it's no wonder. And I'm not saying any of this is like being an apologist for police violence. I'm just saying, like, I think a factor right. of this whole conversation is that in those kinds of situations, the police officers thinking like, well, I have a gun. What if this person tries to take my gun from me? Right. And if their response is like, well, I don't really know what I'm doing, so I'm activating my, I'm freaked out fight or flight response, then yeah, it's no wonder that a lot of this stuff happens. I mean, that alone is I'm sure a huge contributing factor to a lot of police deaths that happen with Black people and white people alike. But definitely, like you're saying, there's a stigma associated where, you know, if you're a Black person, you kind of just have a natural fear of the police. Like, oh, I'm pulled over. What? Like, what did I do? Those different kinds of things. Whereas white people often don't have to think those same kinds of things. No. So I'm interested to learn and read more about that whole thing. But yeah, to your comment about police reform, I think that's definitely an opportunity is, you know, what are some less lethal ways to control people in those situations where you aren't shooting them, you know, where you're not using your gun to do things, you're using your body. And you don't have to be a big, strong right. person to use jiu-jitsu, from my understanding. In fact,
you'd be a little petite, like 4'10" person and still like completely disarm somebody, bring them down to the ground. I don't know. I actually want to insert my probably unpopular opinion here, but I think modern opinion, where it's 2021, there is a lot of really cool technology that could be employed. There's absolutely no reason that law enforcement in the United States of America needs to have lethal firearms. Honestly, any law enforcement anywhere.
Do you think that could be potentially, and I don't know enough about this to realize, I'm legitimately asking to see if you know, is do you think that's because law enforcement, they're like, they have federal or local grants with some of the firearm producers and like they have contracts to buy firearms from some of those companies?
Oh, I have no doubt that that is part of it. I mean, that kind of stuff, those kind of like, that kind of lobbying exists everywhere in right. our government, you know, because it's a market. It's a market for gun manufacturers. But I mean, you can make a projectile shooting device, a gun, if you may, that shoots bullets that just incapacitate people, whether it's gives them an electric shock or hits them with like some kind of, you know, non-lethal gas that puts them to sleep, whatever it is. There's a lot of really creative potential alternatives that can be used. And if you, and the big argument is, well, criminals carry guns. Yeah, but you make a weapon that can do, that can make guns, that can compete with guns, if not make them useless.
Right.
Anyway.
There's a lot of value in exploring that. And I think there.
Yeah. There's a lot of human value yeah. in exploring.
Yeah,
that.
Absolutely. I mean, do you have any thoughts on how faith can be restored in law enforcement in general, especially from the Black community?
Honestly, dude, that's such a,
it's a loaded question, but
I think if you're going to, if things are going to change, like with anything, you have to treat this like if your neighbor shoots your son, how are you going to make amends with your neighbor? Well, it's going to take a lot of severe, contrite, you know, showing of apology and reform. Yeah. First, and then it's going to take a lot of cooperation and collaboration to make sure that it doesn't happen again and that the system gets made better. That is improved. And I think it's not going to be something that happens
so
in
you
a
think,
few years.
Regardless of what approach is taken, it's going to take a pretty significant amount of time.
Yes, 100%. Because it's been going on for such a significant amount of time. You know, there is so much African-American blood that has been unneedlessly spilt in the history of our country. And all of that is going to take time to heal and overcome.
It's a good perspective. Yeah, I think there's definitely going to have to be some intention around repairing some of those. I do think the media in some capacity, when there is some police reform, that there's coverage. Because right now, I mean, I can't think of the last time I've seen a positive light of a law enforcement story, like of anything that,
right,
that law enforcement has done. It's always been, at least within recent memory, all the horrible things that police officers have done. And so I don't think that fully encapsulates everything everywhere. I think we're seeing some of the more horrific, you know, awful mistreatment, especially of Black people. And I think,
right,
that the media does have some responsibility in sharing some of the work that's being done for police reform when that does happen at a wider scale. I know there are tons of obstacles to make that happen from a legislative standpoint, but
that actually, speaking of the media, is a whole nother episode in itself. I mean, the media is like the devious person on the side that's poking the fires, because they benefit when the fires are,
right,
poked.
That gains viewership.
You know, they it gains viewership. And I don't know. I have mixed feelings.
I do
about
too.
The
yeah,
media.
And I'm definitely not saying that as a defense of any of the things. I'm more just saying, like, I think there's media is incentivized by making things kind of scary and violent and showing like all the things that are wrong, the dangers
all the
of
terrible
our world.
Things.
And I think that there's plenty of space to also do some honest journalistic reporting on the state of things when that does happen. And I have hope that there will be some movements that local, regional, and state law enforcement agencies can get behind that enable to restore some social trust in communities and people that see just law enforcement in general as a partner in their safety rather than like overwatching and an enemy. Yeah, I think that's a possibility, yeah. And I have hope that that'll happen in the near future. Okay, well, do you have any other thoughts around this topic? I know we kind of went down a few rabbit holes, but it's a big topic, and
as we always do. Right. I think one last thing maybe is I've heard a lot of big argument against Black Lives Matter or police shootings, whatever it may be, is the riots. People like try to use the riots as like the forefront of their argument. Like, it's just not right to destroy people's property. Like, that is just, if you're gonna try to get things changed, if you're gonna try to do something about this injustice, well, you shouldn't destroy people's livelihoods, you know, like brand new small hometown mom and pop businesses just being absolutely destroyed by these riots. And it's like, some of that stuff is happening, but on the whole, Black Lives Matters, like protests is what they are usually,
right,
peaceful. They get dangerous and violent when people get, you know, you have riot cops
provoked
out there trying
and,
to break
yeah.
it up, or you you have situations like with that kid, and I forget, can't remember his name, the kid who shot the protesters,
yeah, that was awful.
In that one. Right? Like, one thing that white America needs to understand is there is a lot of pent up frustration and grief and anger that has been building up, not just last couple of years, but for the like last couple of hundred years. And it is kind of coming to a head right now. And so when there's riots where windows are being broken and livelihoods are being destroyed, it's about fucking time that, and sorry, I'm getting like all kinds of emotional, like that this changes, because America is better than this, and it was founded on the principles of being better than this, and we are still so far from being there.
That's a really fair criticism, and I feel like there's definitely plenty of space for us to accept and embrace some of the less humane ways of our past as a wider society and say, look, like, this is the way things used to be, and there are still remnants of that that live in our society, and we need to do our best to combat that on a daily basis. And it's not a, okay, we went through training, now we're done. It's a constant having conversations about it, being vulnerable, admitting when you're ignorant about something and saying like, hey, look, I don't understand this very well. And that's not a reliance on, you know, an African-American person to educate you on their experience. But if they feel comfortable sharing some of that with you, and you're actually, you're not pandering, and you're legitimately wanting to know like, hey, how can I be a better advocate or support you? Those are things worth doing. And really just being honest about where you're at and how you're feeling and what you're doing. It's all about intention, and people can see that. So I really appreciate that perspective. Okay. Well, I have a few things for the Be Kind, and we'll be back unless there's anything else that you wanted to add.
Let's move on.
Hello.
Let's be kind, Ryan.
Yes, let's do it. Okay, so I did a little bit of research, and this is from Berkeley, and they have it's basically called a Greater Good Science Center, and they talk about anti-racism and some ways to participate in that movement. And there's a thing that I'll link to in the episode notes called the Anti-Racist Tables 30-Day Challenge. And it is basically like a way to participate in a way that's pretty structured. But there are 10 keys to like big topics around participating in this work. The first one is education. I'm just going to kind of like high level these things really quick. I'll link to this article as well if you want to read all the details, but I'll just kind of briefly go over what each of the things are, and then if you're interested in learning more, I will link to that article as well. But the first one is education. So Ibram Kendi, we've talked about him in our first episode. He basically argues that the heart of racism is denial. And so understanding that the history of African Americans and the Black experience is a good way to understand how systemic racism exists. And there are a few helpful links to understand different ways that, you know, the United States has been systemically racist, and some policies and different things that are linked there. The second is intention. So, you know, being anti-racist is kind of a way of life. You don't just do it once and say you're finished, kind of like what I mentioned in our discussion a little bit ago, you have to kind of show up every day and make an effort to do that. So hold attention about it. The third is courage. If you're a white person, accepting that there's white privilege, that there are really true hard facts about racism, and understanding that white supremacy exists and existed, that those kinds of topics are kind of tough to discuss, but having some vulnerability and being able to open yourself up to talk about it and be vulnerable with other people is a good thing. The fourth is individuality. So being able to see someone as an individual rather than a group. One of the big problems with racism is that people are lumped into groups and assumed that, well, all black people are this, or all white people are this. And so trying to make sure that you're individualizing people helps you also to not dehumanize them, which is the next thing, which is, you know, making sure that you are not dehumanizing people by making it a good versus evil argument. I want to make sure that we understand that we're being empathetic toward other people and their personal relationships between conflicting parties and the pursuit of common goals. The sixth is anti-racist work. Somebody who is anti-racist, as Ibram Kendi quotes, is a person who is supporting an anti-racist policy through their actions or expressing an anti-racist idea. And these are a few things you can do to be anti-racist is holding police with records of excessive force accountable, educating Americans about systemic racism and racist policies and the need to dismantle them, reparations to address the wealth gap between black families and white created by slavery, Jim Crow legislation and segregation, anti-black practices such as redlining and other discriminatory public policies, in criminal justice and education that have withheld opportunities to build wealth from black people that have been afforded to whites. The seventh is equality. So understanding that racial inequity is when two or more racial groups are not standing on approximately equal footing. Gotta hold all groups of people, a color, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, religion, ability, age, any combination of those is equal. Empathy is number eight. So you have to cultivate empathy to rehumanize the dehumanized. And empathy is an umbrella term that describes multiple ways people respond to one another, including sharing, thinking about, and caring about each other's feelings. We know that from studies, empathy creates connection and it breaks down the us and them divide so that we can see outsiders as human beings. There's allyship, which is number nine, to be an ally is to take on the struggle as if it is your own. So you have to do things that are uncomfortable, committed to taking a risk, sharing any privilege you have to center marginalized black and brown people. And when you see something, say something, imagine and act as if you don't have a choice and you have to fight to dismantle injustice. And the last one, which is number 10, is love. So you choose love and healing over fear and oppression. And this is a path of courageous vulnerability. Gratitude, joy, and an open heart are all components of love that enable one to do the work to be anti-racist and to bring anti-racism into daily life. The more deeply we feel our own life, the more we experience our interconnectedness with others. This kind of love is a force for change. It bestows the courage to face the suffering in the world and the energy to act for its healing. That's a quote from Orin J. Sofer. So those, I kind of...
Due to technical difficulties, we have now skipped directly to the recommendation.
Yes, due to technical difficulties. AirPods are not as I thought they were.
Oh, Ryan, your AirPods are dead? They're dead?
They are.
They are. I threw them in the trash. I thought they were. I keep buying more. Like, I'll put them in and listen to them, and then I'll be able to use them for a while, and then they just stop working, so I just keep throwing them away. And that came with this cord. I guess I don't know what the cord's for, but I've been spending a lot of money on AirPods. So.
Yeah, that's probably for the best. Their AirPods are the best, so can't get without them. So in light of our conversation this week and our quote that we chose, I want to suggest a book by David Blight. Are you familiar with any David Blight's work?
I don't believe so.
The book I've read by him is A Slave No More. It's a book about an escape from slavery to freedom, and
I've heard of it. I haven't
made it all the way through that book, but I did a little research, saw that he made a recent book, actually, 2019.
Oh, cool.
On Frederick Douglass. It's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom.
Nice.
And I think it's something that I want to read, and I'm sure you would like to as well, or anyone who's listening. He has a very unique and interesting life. And he is one of the loudest abolitionist voices of the 18th century.
Yeah, you know that about him. Yeah.
And I think this is worth some time. It doesn't look like too big of a read, so. Yes, it's Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, by David W. Blight. And it actually won a Pulitzer Prize, too. Fun fact.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Thanks for the recommendation.
You're welcome. All right. Well,
we went plenty of directions today.
We opened up a lot of cans of worms.
Which means that we could have branches out, which I think there would be value in talking about some of those topics that we brought up today in more depth. And Jim recommended this a long time ago. I think it was actually in our first episode, the podcast 1619 by the New York Times. And it is very, very good if you're interested in learning a little more about the origins of slavery in the United States and understanding how the Black experience from that time until very recently. Mm-hmm. It does a really good job of doing a good narrative, like storytelling of like actual people who lived, and then weaving in a lot of factual information, and it's really, really, really good.
What's her name, the narrator for it?
I cannot remember her name.
Dude, she's so good though.
Yeah, she does a great job.
Excellent. If there is no one stop shop for kind of empowering yourself with knowledge on the African American situation, but that is a very good start.
Yeah, it gives a good like overview of some really personal stories from people, and also at more of a high level of what that experience looked like.
Indeed. Alrighty. Well, all right. Ryan, another week gone. What are we, like 80 now?
We are. We're so old.
Oh, welcome back to Ryan and Jim's Antique Podcast.
Yes, back in the good old days. I did want to share some cool news is that, you know, where we were at this point last year seemed like we were in this eternal loop of when are we ever going to be able to hang out with people again and do things and be out in public without fear of catching COVID. And Catherine and I are getting our second dose of the vaccine this Sunday. So
nice. We'll be
fully on the way of being vaccinated, and then another few weeks after that, and we'll hit pretty close to full immunity.
Well, Ryan, we need to like make a list of all of the topics that we have said in our episodes that we are going to talk about, because I feel like that list is massive. We just haven't chronicled it yet.
Yeah, that would be good.
Because we could definitely do some more episodes on COVID, for sure.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of plenty of topic.
And there's more gray areas we haven't delved into yet, too. Things like women rights and abortion and God, what else? Like LGBTQ stuff, like...
Yeah, there are a lot of things that we want to talk about. And yeah, we will.
Eventually.
It's a matter of time.
Indeed. All right. Well.
As always,
if you have nothing...
thank you for listening. Those of you out there that are. And Jim, always nice to talk with you about stuff. And we'll see you all soon.
Perfect. Sounds good.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey everybody, thank you for listening to the podcast. We hope you enjoy listening to it as much as Jim and I enjoy making it. If you'd like to subscribe, we will be sending out feature content within the coming weeks, months, and years. So feel free to do that, and we'd love to have you around.
And Ryan, don't forget, we're on social media.
Oh, that's right. We are on Twitter at expandmind, be kind, and that is the letter B. And then we are also on Gmail. If you want to send us an email, it's expandyourmindandbekind@gmail.com.
Yeah, send us questions or any thoughts that anyone may have, and can't wait till the next episode.
Like Dr. Dre.